This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize. Hello and welcome for those of you who are joining us here live or through our recordings. It's a pleasure to have you back. If you're here with us live, welcome to TGIF DTRA, where we gather on many Fridays, not necessarily all Fridays, from 12 to 1 Eastern with different guests discussing current issues around clinical trial conduct, access, and participation. For those of you that can't join us live, well, we do have our content pushed out to you through your favorite podcast platform. Search for Decentralized and you'll find us there. Whether that's Spotify or wherever else you like to click. And while that's a great way to stay current when you're off in the car or off at the gym or wherever people listen to podcasts nowadays, even better if you're able to join us live, because we'll always make room and opportunity for your insights and feedback and questions along the way. Folks who are here with us live, feel free to use the chat as we're going along if you have feedback or questions, and then we'll always make some time in the latter half of our forum here to let you come off mute and share those questions or experiences live. Our topics, remember, they come from you, the folks in our community, so if there is something you'd love to see us cover in the weeks and months ahead, just raise your digital hand, drop us an email, message Amir Kalali, Jane Miles, myself, whether email, LinkedIn, wherever else you like to go to find people. If you're not sure of what LinkedIn is, you can always send an email to secretariat@dtra.org. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe you'd like to be a guest. Maybe you are doing some writing or publishing, or you're putting out some new data. You're doing a presentation at a conference that deserves a little more attention than just that one conference room. And this is a great way to get your knowledge amplified and shared, and let folks raise their hand and join in the conversation. Well, with all of that, I'm really excited to welcome our guest today, because for me, like many of you, Paul Iveson is just an interesting and provocative and thoughtful character on the other side of my LinkedIn and Substack screens. I've always enjoyed following his writings, and I encourage others to do the same. He is a great follow. You know, sometimes there's content online that's just provocative for being a provocateur. But what I've enjoyed about following Paul is he's got data and experience, and there's a point to the post, right? It's it either leads us down a path of thinking differently or maybe creating some opportunities here. So with that, it's a pleasure to welcome you, Paul, to TGIF DTRA. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me and for that great introduction. Excited to talk about whatever is on your mind.
Well, I have a feeling we all of us here in the room are going to have some questions based on a lot of the content you put out. You've left us with no shortage of questions and ideas to dig into. But before we do, Paul, besides being an interesting character on LinkedIn and Substack, who are you? Tell us a little bit about your background that led you to write in the areas that you're focusing and locking into today.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to. There's kind of the standard, how did you get into the clinical trial story, which is somehow you fell bass accurate into it, which I fit that stereotype completely. I had a technology, a background, mostly in software development, database development, and had a client that was running these ads. And at the time, they were running radio ads and newspaper ads, and they were telling people to call an 800 number and a call center. And once they got your medical information, they'd write it all down and fax it off to the site. And that was kind of the end of the process. They really didn't know what happened after that. They knew that the phone was ringing. They knew they were sending a lot of faxes, but they had no way of really demonstrating, did I enroll any patients in that study, or did I just waste a lot of paper? And I just found it a fascinating problem and ended up joining that company. And the more you kind of dig into what patient recruitment is, in my head, I had to learn all the other pieces. Like, you can't really do good patient recruitment if you don't understand what the site is doing. You need to understand what the kind of eventual data plan is, and how the protocol comes together, and all those pieces. And so my kind of curiosity just kept cycling around all of these different parts of the organization. So, as I think you kind of alluded to before, when I start writing, I'm writing about patient recruitment, but you can't just write about patient recruitment. You kind of have to be all over the place and have to understand how all these things fit together, or else you're going to be just bad at patient recruitment. The other half of the question, I guess, personally, we were just talking a bit ago offline, but I'm a lifelong Chicagoan, born and raised there, went to school there at the University of Chicago. But in the last 6 months, have made the jump, joined my wife here in Kansas City, Missouri. So just coming into a lovely spring in Kansas City. It's been a great city. Very excited to do it. We've got some kids off in college or post college, and just the one dog to make sure we get out the door every day.
And so now you're locked in on first patient in, which to me is a really cool Substack. For you, it's probably even more than that. So what is first patient in for folks?
Yeah, so first patient started almost a year ago as a Substack. I think I had some ideas, some thoughts that maybe they're never perfectly aligned with whatever your company or your client wants to be talking about. And so I needed a kind of a safe place to express those things and bring some issues out. And you develop that over the course of the last 9 months. And then just 3 weeks ago, I guess took the leap and turned that into an actual consultancy. And I'm now independent under the First Patient In brand, so under that name. So it's both company focused on improving patient recruitment, but I'm really trying to keep the Substack to be as independent and kind of really just focused on what's going on in the industry as possible.
Is there a predictable cadence we should start to expect from the Substack now? Are you shooting for weekly for us? Is it more reactive based on signals and things you're seeing that are sparking some of these ideas to focus in on?
Yeah, that's always the trick, right? Like, you don't want to just put stuff out there because you're on a schedule to put stuff out there. I do have, in the back of my head, I've got 25 years of stewing on these topics to kind of tap into. So it's not, you don't run out of ideas, at least not in any time soon. So I've been shooting for a weekly-ish, but if something pops up, absolutely. Like, that's always a great place to start, is really kind of trying to wrap your head around, the latest paper or data that has come out, to kind of think through what the implications are.
Well, I like that, a lot of your posts will do some interesting myth busting, which we don't see much of elsewhere. And I'm sure we're going to get into that in the course of this conversation with some of the examples that you've called out, which people just frequently cite and recite as if this is cast in gold, but you're really challenging those assumptions. And again, reflecting back and scrutinizing some of the original data that people have used for those claims, which I really appreciate. But before we start start to go too far back in your in the Substack history, maybe we could just chat about one of your most recent posts. The most recent one you have from just about a week ago, "Good Campaigns Often Don't Look Like It." In that one, I think you're trying to paint this picture that sponsors might look at the aggregate data across a particular recruitment campaign and wave the victory flag that that this was a smashing success, but that's not necessarily the case for all of the sites within that program. Some may be nodding their heads, others may have their heads down shaking. And why is there this mismatch? What's the underlying story there?
And that one started again, kind of with a kind of persistent observation of a disconnect, right? Which is, if you go on LinkedIn or you go to a site conference, and you start talking to site owners, the negative sentiment about enrollment campaigns, patient recruitment campaigns, is high, and has been high and sustained for long periods of time.
Specifically, these like centrally run campaigns that not campaigns that an individual site is budgeted to run, but at sort of that central level.
Exactly. And I've had folks just say, like, these campaigns do not work. They will tell me that to my face with utter sincerity, that the campaigns do not work.
They'll say, "Give me the budget that you would have given that central campaign, because that central campaign is doing me no good," but clearly you're spending a lot on it.
And on the other side, over the past 20 years, we have more of these campaigns than we've ever had before. Sponsors are building out their own internal recruitment teams more than they were in the past, and setting up and running those campaigns. So they're seeing something. They're seeing an ROI. They're not just doing it because they've been told. Like, the inertial move, the do nothing move, would be to just keep giving sites their stipend. And what you've seen is a move by sponsor teams to bring that centralized, either hiring a vendor or even bringing a centralized team in place to run it. So it becomes an interesting question, right? Like, how can you have the same thing be perceived as a success here and as an absolute failure here? And that's the kind of question that you got to go to the data for. You got to, like, it should be answerable. We should understand what the people are seeing. And I think there are more factors than what I covered, but part of it is the absolute unequal distribution of success in those campaigns. You typically have 25, sometimes even 20% of sites that are just driving a tremendous amount of enrollment through those campaigns. They've got the infrastructure or the processes or the desire to onboard new patients and to bring them in from those campaigns, and then they can set them and randomize them. And you've got a long tail of folks who don't do that. And those folks who don't do it, just look at, you sent me 30 names, you sent me this lead list, and none of them turned into a patient, or one of them turned into a patient. So, and you think about the ROI on having to call and kind of play phone tag with 30 people to get one enrolled, it feels terrible. So that just, sparked a little bit of an aha for me. Is this data isn't shared. This data is kept, so from the sponsors looking at this, seeing this overall rise and seeing, oh, 25% of my patients came through this campaign, and that's wonderful, and that helped me, shave 3 4 months off the program. But more than half or more of the sites just don't see that at all, and it's not surprising that they then extrapolate from their own experience.
I imagine that we're going to see an even greater separation of the haves and have-nots around performance here, where some sites have the capacity and the resources to not only invest in the people, but also now some enabling technology around handling that enrollment funnel, whether using some of these different incremental AI products people are bringing to market to handle, inbounds and support different screening and eligibility processes, and other sites just can't make those types of investments. And so it may get even more important because there may not be as elegant a curve. It may just be one big clump on the left and one big clump on the right.
That's a really interesting point, and a important one. If I'm a sponsor trying to figure out how to make that happen, and if I'm a site trying to figure out how to stay afloat and not constantly feel like I am catching up, which has been the story for forever. I do think there's some hope. I do think we see more professional sites. We have sites that have a little bit more business sense. Some of the technologies you mentioned are now being sold directly to sites at price points that honestly 10 years ago were unimaginable. Like some of this stuff is actually affordable. And you know, if it works and sites adopt it, maybe there's opportunity to actually flatten some of that. That historically is where tech is good, right? The initial round of tech is skewed, but then as things get more affordable and everyone can own a cell phone and everyone can then own a smartphone, you know, that the gap between the haves and have-nots does shrink. So that would be the hope, but it's not by any means guaranteed. So you're right to point it out. Like this could get worse if there's not a strong effort to at least share this data and make it kind of available to people.
You know, Amir, I was thinking we could play First Patient in Press Your Luck, and I could put up a big board of different posts, and we could just, you know, randomize which post we want to dig into next, because honestly, we could spin the wheel and go deep on any of these.
Yeah,
But
I
is there a
was
particular
thinking.
one that you're drawn to that you want to unpack next?
Well, you know, I want to step back for a minute and zoom out a little bit, actually. And Paul, I think we'll definitely have more than one session, but I think each of us could probably fill three sessions of questions for you. As you said, you know, patient recruitment touches so many other parts of clinical development. Let's just zoom back a bit. You're talking about, you know, I know you've talked about how enrollment strategy should be a competitive advantage. What are you seeing in the landscape right now in pharma and biotech in terms of, you know, what do you think the proportion is, or how are people, do you think, currently looking at insourcing recruitment versus just putting out to vendors? Just in the sort of big picture, what are you seeing at the moment first?
Wow. Yeah, and it is interesting because, you know, I can think of, you know, at least one top 10 pharma that recently just dropped its entire central recruitment team. So you always have to be careful when drawing the trends, right? But I do think, especially in the smaller companies, mid-sized biotechs, and even the you know, two compound, you know, three trial kind of biotechs, there has definitely been a push to say we cannot outsource as much of this as we thought we could, and we need to bring more folks in. Do they know exactly who to bring in? You know, is there going to be a rash of hirings of chief patient recruitment officers? Like, I probably not. I kind of hope not. But I do think there's a general trend of realization that this is important, and if I just outsource it into a black box, my chances of success are pretty low right now. So I've definitely talked to a number of biotechs that I would never have thought would have hired in, you know, patient recruitment or patient engagement folks that are now seriously moving in that direction.
I mean, it does seem like a strategic area to really be able to understand and hit on, right? The second question I have for you, as Craig said, I completely agree with him that unlike maybe others who just like to provoke, you know, the way you approach and some others I know, you know, is very data-based and thinking about, you know, what does data show? One of the things I find kind of frustrating, whether it's the studies that you've actually taken apart or whether any sort of analysis of data is, as you mentioned, the site landscape is not homogeneous, right? So very different, and even more so depending on the indication. So for me, when we kind of look at any big study that makes generalizations about sites across the board, it just, to me, it's kind of so diluted, it's almost worthless. In the sense that if I'm running a study in a particular disease area, quite honestly, you know, there are a very set of challenges in that disease area and your PI set and X, which means that, you know, looking at the broader picture is not necessarily helpful to me, right, when I'm doing that. So I'm always sometimes kind of a bit frustrated where when we make generalizations about anything, and frankly, when a team is looking at a particular disease area, it's really understanding that disease area, you know, what the are the investigators all academic, which is actually true in some indications, you know. And then you mentioned kind of you hinted at the kind of the larger networks now who do argue that they bring more professionalism to things like patient recruitment right across the board. So it is a quite complex kind of, as we all know, nuanced area where making generalizations, in fact, in some ways is kind of difficult and not particularly useful in my mind. What do you think about that?
So the way I started with that was, any statement of the form, what patients want is, you've immediately got me, you've lost me, right? It's what patients want is not a thing. Like, it's never going to be one thing. There's too much variation. There's too much difference between us. We tend to have a kind of insular view because, maybe all the people we talk to are very similar to us. And we kind of miss that bigger picture. But to your point, the site's very much the same way. Maybe not as massively different as a human to human, differences, but the idea, we have private practice physicians who run research on the side as a site. And to say that they are, the same as major state university chain is just kind of strange. And if you say 30% of sites want X, that is really unhelpful piece of data, no matter what X is, right? And it's just not going to work. So it is strange, right? I mean, even if you just did a really simple segment, you said, okay, well, there's three basic types of sites or four basic types of sites, and I just kind of talked about generalities and similarities in those groups. You're at least, I mean, you're not perfect, but you're at least you, now we're actually probably, talking about something that's real in the world and helpful to making decisions.
Right. That's my first one, Craig. And Jane, Jean, anyone else wants to go? I have plenty more, but I'll take turns.
Jane, I know you've got some questions on your mind.
Well, I'm going to go into the different part of the ecosystem, the sponsor world. So, Paula, I kind of ended up in this bass ackwards too. I think I told you. Literally, my boss came to me and said, "Hey, we just spent $1 million for one patient. Why did that happen?" It wasn't my study. I had no idea. And so that one question sort of changed the whole trajectory of where I went next. But I really loved the Substack article where you wrote about the difference between the recruitment team and the ClinOps team to whom they are pitching and then hopefully collaborating with, right? You've got the creatives and you've got the process geeks, that's me. So I want to explore with you this concept of study branding a little bit and why that became a thing. And in today's world, if somebody showed up to you from sponsor X and said, "We need a study brand," where would you take that question and how would you help evaluate, is this actually useful?
Absolutely. Because this is a topic I come back to a lot with, looking at the recruitment vendor ecosystem, right? So many of them come from kind of more traditional and want to import traditional stuff, and some of it is helpful, right? It's not a black and white situation, but a lot of it is not recognizing the kind of differences in what's going on in a clinical trial. So I guess first and foremost, obviously, like, if you want to give the study a name and you want to present it as a thing with an identity, as opposed to, a series of numbers and letters, like a protocol ID, 100%, of course. Even if you're going to talk to sites, they will do a better job of keeping track of three named studies than of three, numerical sequences. So in that sense, no one should really argue with having a brand, having an at least in the, having an identity. But one thing we forget, which I think I talked about before, is that when I create a brand in the rest of the world, that brand is kind of supposed to live forever, right? And you want to kind of accumulate good feelings or specific feelings about the brand, right? If I say Nike or if I say Ford or whatever it is, you're trying to get people, and that's a decades-long process to build that up. And you hire teams to protect your brand and kind of cultivate it. Clinical trial is done in 12 months, in 18 months. So that kind of discipline, that kind of brand building is a little bit of a waste, frankly, right? And so you need to really start to take a lot of those kind of best practices that your creative team wants to bring and say what fits and what doesn't. So that's where I would certainly start.
So is it, I mean, we'll get off this in a second, but I am just reliving all the branding conversations and the horror of legal compliance and my regulatory affairs groups regarding color and stylist, all that stuff. Like,
But Jane, step
it
one was
can't
coming up with the most absurd acronym that could include, the
Bruce.
second letters of words to randomly make it spell something arbitrary.
Oh, all that, yes. So then, Paul, how might we better use this concept of branding at the program or molecule level? And is there a path to actually connect it somehow to what happens in the commercialization domain without
Ooh.
violating principles?
Yeah. So first off, just because he snuck it in there, I love the weird reverse engineered acronyms. If a team comes up with that and they're geeked out about like, oh, I pulled this and I spelled Liberty. Like, well, great. Like, do that. Like, absolutely. Don't hire an agency to do that. If your team is excited and he comes up with a name, lovely. Like that. That's such a good thing. And it's not going to be a unique name, but most trial names aren't unique anymore, right? No one's, it's not like drug names where we're trying to find, unique things in this ever declining white space.
Paul,
So
I
I
have to
love
imagine it's now the number one use case for ChatGPT and study
that. Right.
design.
It's still more fun to just do it though, right? To just kind of stare at all those words and try to make one up. Or to come up with a name, right? I think they call it a backronym, where you come up with a name first, and then you try to figure out how it really you can build it out of the words. But Jane, to your point, like, and I guess it's the same point. Like, why we should not invest this level of depth in, like, this is the branding, this is the brand guide, this is the brand book for this trial, right? Like, if you're a sponsor and you've got a brand. Again, that's supposed to live forever, so that's great. But we invest a lot of time and a lot of like legal and regulatory time in those activities, which again are going to be pretty transient and really only serve some very specific purposes.
And Paul, from your post, I mean, I get that people may want a brand for retention and engagement, like some identity, give it a name, make it easier for investigators, for participants once they're in the trial. But from some of your posts, I get the sense people lock themselves into this brand and they end up with ads that are not contextually relevant to the entire breadth of the population that they're trying to engage because they're going after needles and haystacks, not trying to raise awareness of everybody to get excited about Nike being their next sneaker.
Yeah. Yeah, because then that's kind of where you flip from, I think you're kind of wasting some time and some effort by over engineering your brand. But when you get to the advertising, now you flip to actively hurting your program, right? If you think that a brand identity across all ads is what's going to attract people. Like, people are not going to see this at the volume and regularity that they would see a brand ad. And so, yeah, I include an example, and I don't even know who had it out there, but it was a campaign. The website had a very specific look. All of the materials had a very specific look, but the ads were all over the place, and the ads were clearly thinking about what are the, to our previous point, right? Not all patients are the same. So what is the patient that has this kind of emotional reaction to their condition? Or what's the patient that has an analytical, like needs to get an answer, needs to get an option on the table. And they were able to kind of be bad from a branding perspective. They broke that rule, and those are just going to be much more successful because you're not going to find the one thing that unifies all the people you need to connect with.
So, Paul, I'm going to switch to kind of more fundamental question for you, if that's okay. the biggest frustration most people have is the gap in reality between projections of enrollment and what actually happens, right? I remember many years ago addressing, I don't know, 1,000 drug developers in a meeting, and I asked, and most of them, were ClinOps people, R&D leaders, and I said, "Can someone tell me, out of 1,000 people, what is the science behind patient enrollment?" And not one person put their hand up. Okay, maybe you can tell us what the science is behind patient enrollment. And my answer was very tongue in cheek. I said, "It's very simple. Let's take a biotech." I said, "The CEO happens to be at a meeting with analysts, and he tells them we're going to have, our NDA date this time." Then he goes home and tells the head of R&D, "That's our NDA date." And the head of R&D tells his team, "Work backwards and come up with the enrollment per month number." That was kind of my joke about how enrollment numbers are made up. My question to you is, as you're advising companies, what should people do differently, even if it's uncomfortable, for them to really get to the point where their projections can be more realistic and to what's going to actually happen and be sort of data-based? What would you advise companies to do a better job with that?
Wow. We could answer that one. I'd have some retirement money already. So, and it's interesting because it's almost worse than you described, right? Because you have an internal feasibility department, and they say, okay, it's going to take this long, and then you put it out to bid for the CROs, and they come back with different, their own projections. You've got an executive date that is kind of set in stone. Maybe you've got an FPI milestone that you've got to hit, regardless of kind of whether the rest of the trial is ready to run or not. So you often, and I've been in this situation where there are literally three, four different target dates there, and no one really wants to commit to one or the other, right? To your point, the one that kind of gets done by fiat tends to end up being the answer, and it is a trick that I think most teams struggle with, is how do you keep kind of two things in your head at one time, which is I have a goal, I have a benchmark that I aspire to, and I have a projection, which is what I think based on the best available evidence I have, and those are not going to be the same. And the biggest trap is if the projection falls short of the benchmark, the goal, people will tell you you're not trying hard enough. You're not being a team player. You're being a naysayer. And creating the space to say we've got two numbers. Like I don't think you have to get rid of the benchmark if that's really your goal and that's what you're shooting for. Understand that. Understand that there are commercial implications to doing that. But I don't think I've seen a team that has just comfortably said, there are multiple numbers here. And I think there's an advantage if you could actually do that to understanding what you're probably going to get to, what you want to get to, and what that gap is, because then you can really start exploring what it would require to cover that gap in a realistic manner. I do think, a lot of times that fiat number is just given with a kind of failure is not an option, pep talk, and it's hard to understand kind of what to do with that, right? And then you get people who just accept that benchmark until it clearly has not happened.
And Paul, you've said that your background was from technology, right? Over the decades, I've seen many technology folks come into clinical trials, claim that the latest technology wave is going to cure recruitment because if only we had the right tech, it would help, right? So, do you think, and I'll be the one to bring it up at minute 35, do you think the latest wave of technology with AI is going to have any impact? Because you've argued that nothing has changed, right? In patient agreement, I don't disagree with that. Do you think anything can be different going forward? Is technology going to somehow help us? Whereas, I mean, I personally believe there's a lot of other issues that are the bigger elephant in the room, but do you think technology can help going forward?
And by the way, we can clock it, time of AI, 12:35.
Yeah, exactly.
AI aside, just technology solutions in general, right? I do joke about things not changing at all. But if I look back 20 years, 25 years, things have changed. We all have EDCs now, and which is lovely. Like, it's a weird thing to claim victory over, but because it seems so basic and simple. But things have improved. Online advertising is way better than broadcast advertising, from a cost per, patient perspective. It's a slow, it's the slow walk uphill that we're all going through, and it's sometimes hard to miss, or hard to see, I guess, hard to catch the improvements that are real and sustained. I have talked to, and one of the joys of my previous job and right now is that I get that opportunity to talk to a lot of these kind of point solutions and different folks who have come out. And will 80, 90% of them kind of fizzle? Like, you're probably right. That's not surprising for any world. But some of them seem intriguing, and you hope, right? One of the, just to pick an example, EMR access, and querying EMRs, whether with algorithms or with AI or with just straight database queries, right, has been a thing for a really long time. The rate limiting factor there mostly feels like the underlying data was just bad, right? We shoveled so much paper documentation into EMRs back in the 2010s with high tech and, all these kind of huge financial incentives to get EMRs operationalized, that you couldn't run a good query. You just get kind of junk back. And so I'm hopeful that the current crop of these EMR prospecting tools, A, are a little smarter and a little better than the previous crop, and that we've had 10, 15 years to get the data a little better in the system. So is it going to solve everything? No. But is it going to make, are we, again, are we on the uphill slope? I hope so. I think so.
I mean, I think, and Petra in the comments makes an extremely good point about, patients can use technology to get into trial or at least be exposed to it, but really they have a lack of trust, right? And that kind of is the barrier, which is a very important point. I mean, I always make an analogy to kind of what I find interesting is sometimes we forget that our potential patients are living in the real world sometimes, maybe, where they're exposed to other things, whether that's Amazon, whether it's hotels, whether it's restaurants, whether how that's changing. And if you think about it, I'm assuming everyone has their favorite restaurants, their favorite hotels, and what did that make them kind of gravitate to those? Are there places you go where you're treated like a number? The whole thing we talk about how clinical trials can be extremely transactional, right? We're sort of doing things to you. Most of the time still don't give you even your data back or whether you're on placebo or not. So what Petra's bringing up kind of for me is kind of one of the big elephants. There's many others where that's kind of the real issues, in terms of really attracting patients to what is at the end of the day still an experiment in most cases, right? So I appreciate Petra with that comment. Any comments on that, Paul?
I appreciate it as well. I agree with it to a certain extent. Sometimes I wonder if we over vilify the kind of transactional piece, to be honest, just to take a sideways step here.
Tell us about it.
And if I think about the technology and the trust piece, like, I just moved to Kansas City. I am trying to find a new primary care doc. Turns out that's really hard. The technology to actually find a physician is that fits my insurance and is accessible to me, is turns out to be really tough. And then I get lists, and I don't know anything about those docs. I don't know about their style or anything that I might care about. And the tech piece is actually what has failed me most right now. And it's interesting because I don't need a lot of trust with my primary care physician. I've never gone to a cookout with my primary care physician. We've never, like, spent time together as people. I just need them to be kind of good at their job and talk to me about, what I need. So I'm not saying trust is irrelevant, but there's still lots of room for technology just to do the block and tackling better and get people what they need. If you're motivated because you're frustrated with your physician and the drug you're prescribed isn't working, and you are actively looking for clinical trials, you're still going to have a hard time getting in the trial because the
Yeah.
tech isn't going to help you, right? The facilitating piece is still, there's a lot of work there to do. So I think these are kind of adjacent and problems, the trust and patient friendliness and kind of customability, but the actual just enablement and getting you there is, if we think we've solved that with technology, like we haven't really tried to be in a trial because there's a lot of plenty, there's plenty of work to do to make that happen.
So let's go to Latanya's question, and then I've got one that I'm gonna put out there after we address this. This might be a meaty question, Paul. So, Latanya, do you want to come off mute and share your question, or do you want us to read it? You get to decide.
Read it, and if I probably might have something to spin off as a result of
Just go for it.
So just really quickly, I'm looking to create a network of sites, initially targeting Black physicians so that we can increase our patient population within the Black community and when it comes to clinical research. So I just wanted to know if you had any, suggestions or insights with your experience as to what we could do to target, engage PIs as well as the patient population as well.
Yeah, I'd be curious. My sense is, if I'm looking specifically to engage, PIs in minority populations, that they're there and they're waiting. They're frustrated that they don't get the connectivity, right? The people who are PIs. There's a whole bunch of physicians who I think there's always those questions of could they become PIs? Could they? And there's so many structural burdens associated with that. Not that those shouldn't be tackled, but like just realize that that's not a thing you're going to solve in a couple of weeks or even a couple of months. But I do wonder, and it's a great question. I know there are groups like Acclinate. I just had a great conversation with Bill Smith, Acclinate, who are kind of looking at some of these, very similar, areas of opportunity and how do you build those communities. So again, though, I wonder, the tricky part, I think, is always still first treating the patient as a patient with their specific condition and their specific concerns, right? I don't, necessarily want my medical treatment defined by any other aspect of me besides my condition. And I think a lot of people are like that. Not everyone. I'm not going to go into saying what patients want after I just ranted about that. But I do think that a number of these organizations have started with the kind of group identity and then try to focus in on the patient piece. And maybe there's room still to really acknowledge, especially in underserved areas, that the specific underserving is for your condition, right? That is the problem that a lot of people will express, and so whether that's kind of providing more content or more support in a much more precise way, like starting with a condition that and I know there are groups out there that are specific to breast cancer or, other groups, like think that would be my first place to like really start exploring. Is be less general. I think we got a lot of general communities out there already. But the stuff that seems to move the needle when you really start thinking about are ones that where the people come together because they all are suffering from this condition or you see it hugely with you can tell with the rest of the panel here in rare disease. But I think that's true across the board where there's unmet need.
Latanya,
Understood.
one thing Paul shared there that kind of sticks out to me is there are a number of initiatives out there to try to help research naive physicians to become investigators. But in this case, are there established investigators of color that are not being fully recognized and utilized to their greatest potential. And
Mm-hmm.
one thing that always stuck with me was a breadcrumb that the head of development at the large farm I used to work for had once shared. She said, you can do almost anything in innovative in your trials if you start with investigators we know and trust. And so, it's an interesting question of do you focus on trying to convert research naive physicians to become PIs, or do you start with existing PIs that just aren't being fully leveraged and utilized to their greatest potential, and try to, amplify from there? It's an interesting question, I'm sure, for you as you think about building this out.
Well, for me, my target was kind of a hybrid, obviously, because we need some leverage, with some PIs who are already participating. For example, I've already been partnering with Dr. Jose at Rutgers just to have a partner with the research aspect and knowledge, because that's really her background as well. But one of the things that she and I were discussing when, I first pitched this to her was that a lot of physicians just simply aren't asked, if they're interested in becoming a PI, and they also don't have the resources. They're already struggling with those particular aspects as far as, having coordinators and everything, in addition to, their regular daily staff that they need, separate from that. So my goal was to, kind of help them with that aspect of it. But obviously, like you said, it's the convincing the sponsors to appreciate that, just because they're research naive doesn't mean that, one, they're not willing to learn, two, they don't have the capability to do better than some of the PIs that we actually have in the industry.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I think that's a Herculean task to get sponsors on board with research naive physicians. I mean, I know ACRP has an initiative to looking at this. I know Milken Institute has an initiative looking at this. I think SCRS has one. There are at least two or three of the Big Ten sponsors, I won't name their names, that have at least kind of programs or side projects or incubators that are looking at this. But it's been that way for years. Like I
One DTRA resource I'll just do a shout out for, Jane, is there are roles for physicians today beyond being an investigator. And one area that DTRA has been working actively with a number of sponsors and others is to pick up on the guidance from a year and a half ago, the DCT guidance from FDA, calling out the opportunity for healthcare providers to support routine care activities and trials. And that to me is almost our minor league entry point for a physician. Rather than take a physician and say, I'll turn them into a PI, how about they just start by supporting the routine care activities and trials? And we'll point to some resources that the DTRA has been putting out with physician insights there. Jane, any other feedback on that topic?
Lots to say. I'm going to keep it short. I was actually working on that Milken Institute initiative, Paul, and we have our draft white paper in version one. And a really interesting reflection that came up this week as people were reviewing it is even with the tool, it looks really hard. So we're going to have to make a reason for people to want to do this because when you document everything that's required, it looks really over the top in terms of need. Latanya, I'm gonna chime in here with my question now. It's a little different theme, but I just can't let it go. Sorry. In that theme of build versus buy, like we've talked a lot about how there are different things you can build, and sponsors are starting to build their own capabilities again, et cetera. I want to go over to registries, patient registries specifically. And I feel like there are, this is an opinion, I kind of feel like we're oversaturated with patient registries. So if you were advising a sponsor right now who had a very specific need for patients, and let's say there were registries already available in that domain, maybe a couple of them, would you build? Would you buy? What would you do?
That's a good question.
That's a Paul
I guess
question.
we could say it would depend on the, for me, the indication,
Yeah.
and what the study is.
And let's bounce that over to our guest this week, Paul.
So the first thing, I feel like I start every answer with it with an asterisk, but I'm gonna do it again. The first thing to note is that registries have potential value above and beyond just recruitment, right? If I can have a registry, especially in certain rare cases where I can build a natural history study, and potentially that could turn into a control arm of a future study, assuming the FDA ever acknowledges the existence of external control arms again, that could be great, right? From a pure recruitment perspective, like I want to enroll patients in a trial, or a series of trials. I think we've more than proven that these databases, warehouses, whatever you want to call them, sometimes it's registry is a really polite word. We've 20 years of them not working. Right? Quintiles had MediGuard in the 2000s. So you can amass millions of names in a database. You're probably not going to enroll a trial. I don't think that's changing, right? The window in which you as a person might want to participate in the study, and having that window line up when you are medically eligible with the laundry list of trial criteria, right, is pretty narrow. And I continue to see people selling, and some people obviously still buying into the idea that I can tap into a database. I've never seen a success story. I can't say it won't work, but it doesn't seem reasonable at all. Except in very specific, if I'm collecting people with a specific genetic marker, or a really niche population, and then again, there are other benefits maybe to having that data available. But from a recruitment perspective, this is like one of those, to me, very well settled questions, with data and with a lack of success that we somehow, some folks just won't drop. Like they will continue to sell it until they can't sell it anymore.
But let's be, I don't want to throw shade on registries in general. There's a lot of reasons why a patient group would have a registry, and recruitment is but one use case, right?
Yeah, like I said, that if
You have
there's you
natural
get a
history data,
control
there's
arm, you get
other.
a natural history study, those are amazing potential resources and can speed up development, or sometimes even make development possible when it really, couldn't happen otherwise.
And then, gee, I had another registry question. So, what about the concept of, I'll call them meta registries or mega registries, where maybe it isn't for a single trial, maybe it's for a host of trials, and maybe the concept is there's a reuse case here if you've enrolled and didn't screen. Then you might get matched. Have you seen that work? Have you got thoughts on what it would take to make it work? It's a big, meaty question.
Yeah, it's a big, and I know there are some initiatives out there right now specifically in that kind of can you do a multi-trial screening. I mean it I can't say it doesn't make sense, right? It totally makes sense on paper when you plot it out. If your chances of being eligible for any one study are small, which they are because protocols are tightly written and trying to get a very specific population, why wouldn't I, index you across as many studies as might be feasible. I think there's a lot to unpack there. There's a lot of logistic hurdles. And so I would not be shocked if the first couple iterations of people bringing those things to market didn't fare very well, right? Anyone who thinks this is an easy problem, I've solved it because now I'm doing multi, I mean, we did multi-trial matching in Trial Finder kind of environments for decades now, and again we have pretty good data that doesn't seem to help much. So acknowledging that, this is there are probably 8 difficult problems you got to kind of sequentially solve in order to make something like that work. And if you're down for doing that work and that effort, like I think there's a there, right? There's light that could make that work. You always worry that the first people out the gate are going to kind of spoil it because it's they're going to come out with something that's kind of half thought through, but.
We are in the final 3 minutes, and Paul, one of my favorite things that you tackle on Substack is a bit of myth busting. You dropped a very provocative one on something that gets amplified quite a bit around are all the sites dying? That story that 50% of investigators are one and done. Wait a minute, no, maybe it's not 50%. Maybe it's 60%. And so. You started to dig into that. Can you give us the 2-minute synopsis? Are half of investigators one and done?
Yeah. So yeah, I think the 2 seconds opposite is no, clearly not. We've all met sites, we all know sites that persist. And so you should really have some strong prior beliefs about this when the data comes out in a different way. The one and done, we actually had an extensive back and forth on that. And I couldn't even really find people to truly defend that number anymore, even though they'll repeat it. It's based on an incomplete, very incomplete data set. In Bemis, the 80, 60, 80 is 80% by year five. The sites are gone, are dying was the provocative term used, was just built on a complete misinterpretation of what is in the data. And that's a thing we do a lot of, surprisingly, right? Is just like, well, this is the best data we've got, so I'll just run an analysis on it. Which is amazing because our trials are so thoughtful and so precise, and really, we work so hard at eliminating bias and really trying to detect a clean signal of efficacy and safety on our drugs. And then we get any other data set, and this kind of stuff happens. I don't quite know how we manage to be both those things at the same time.
And it gets propagated and repeated and repeated. And in this
Yeah.
case, it sounds like the questionable element was, can we rely on voluntary 1572 submission databases or rely on clinicaltrial.gov listings that name a very specific investigator site and trust those as reliable data sources to draw
Yeah,
conclusions?
free form text entry field on a public website. Like, what would be the more, it could be
What
more
could go
rigorous and
wrong?
reliable than that, right? It's fascinating.
Amir, Jane, we're going to have Paul back. What do you think?
I think we're going to see some things that'll raise more questions this year. So yeah, please.
Excellent.
I'd love the right to recall the witness, Paul, if that's okay with you.
Awesome. All right. It's been
Thank you so
fun.
much. Thank you. Thank
Great to
you.
have you here. Thanks everyone for joining. For those of you joining live, thank you, Latanya, for bringing your question forward and others in the chat. Always welcome and appreciated. And for those that joined us through the recording, have a safe drive, safe flight, good workout, whatever it is that's keeping you motivated to listen. And we'll look forward to hearing your feedback on upcoming topics and look forward to seeing you again soon. Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.